This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Sound of Waves, written by Yukio Mishima, narrated by Brian Nishi.
Chapter 1. Utajima, Song Island, has only about 1,400 inhabitants and a coastline of something under 3 miles. The island has two spots with surpassingly beautiful views. One is Yashiro Shrine, which faces northwest and stands near the crest of the island. The shrine commands an uninterrupted view of the wide expanse of the Gulf of Ise, and the island lies directly in the straits connecting the gulf with the Pacific Ocean. The Chita Peninsula approaches from the north, and the Atsumi Peninsula stretches way to the northeast. To the west, you can catch glimpses of the coastline between the ports of Ujiyamada and Yokkaichi in Tsu. By climbing the 200 stone steps that lead up to the shrine and looking back from the spot where there is a torii guarded by a pair of stone temple dogs, you can see how these distant shores cradle with their arms the storied Gulf of Ise, unchanged through the centuries. Once there were two torii pines growing here, their branches twisted and trained into the shape of a torii, providing a curious frame for the view, but they died some years ago. Just now, the needles of the surrounding pine trees are still dull green from winter, but already the spring seaweeds are staining the sea red near the shore. The northwest monsoon blows steadily from the direction of Tsu, making it still too cold to enjoy the view. Yashiro Shrine is dedicated to Watatsumi no Mikoto, God of the Sea. This is an island of fishermen, and it is natural that the inhabitants should be devout worshippers of this god. They are forever praying for calm seas, and the very first thing they do upon being rescued from some peril of the sea is to make a votive offering at the sea god's shrine. The shrine possesses a treasure of some 66 bronze mirrors. One is a grape design mirror from the 8th century. Another is an ancient copy of a Chinese mirror of the 6th dynasty's period, of which there are not more than 15 or 16 in all Japan. The deer and squirrels carved on its back must have emerged centuries ago from some Persian forest and journeyed halfway around the earth, across wide continents and endless seas, to come finally to rest here on Utajima. The other most beautiful view on the island is from the lighthouse near the summit of Mount Higashi, which falls in a cliff to the sea. At the foot of the cliff, the current of the Irako Channel sets up an unceasing roar. On windy days, these narrow straits connecting the Gulf of Ise and the Pacific are filled with whirlpools. The tip of the Atsumi Peninsula juts out from across the channel, and on its rocky and desolate shore stands the tiny, unmanned beacon of Cape Irako. Southeast from the Utajima Lighthouse, you can see the Pacific, and to the northeast, across Atsumi Bay and beyond the mountain ranges, you can sometimes see Mount Fuji, say, at dawn when the west wind is blowing strong. When a steamship sailing to or from Nagoya or Yokkaichi passed through the Irako Channel, threading its way among the countless fishing boats scattered the length of the channel between the gulf and the open sea, the lighthouse watchman could easily read its name through his telescope. The Tokachimaru, a Mitsui Line freighter of 1,900 tons, had just come within telescopic range. The watchman could see two sailors dressed in gray work clothes, talking and stamping their feet on the deck. Presently, an English freighter, the Talisman, sailed into the channel, bound for port. The watchman saw the sailors clearly, looking very tiny as they played quoits on the deck. The watchman turned to the desk in the watchhouse and, in a log marked Record of Shipping Movements, entered the vessel's names, signal marks, sailing directions, and the time. Then he tapped this information out on a telegraph key, warning cargo owners in the ports of destination to begin their preparations. It was afternoon, and the sinking sun had been cut off by Mount Higashi, throwing the vicinity of the lighthouse into shadow. A hawk was circling in the bright sky over the sea. High in the heavens, the hawk was dipping now one wing and then the other, as though testing them, and just when it seemed about to plummet downward, instead it suddenly slipped backward on the air, and then soared upward again on motionless wings. After the sun had completely set, a young fisherman came hurrying up the mountain path leading from the village past the lighthouse. He was dangling a large fish in one hand. The boy was only 18, having finished high school just last year. He was tall and well-built beyond his years, and only his face revealed his youthfulness. Skin can be burned no darker by the sun than his was burned. He had the well-shaped nose characteristic of the people of this island, and his lips were cracked and chapped. His dark eyes were exceedingly clear, but their clarity was not that of intellectuality. It was a gift that the sea bestows upon those who make their livelihood upon it. As a matter of fact, he had made notably bad grades in school. He was still wearing the same clothes he fished in each day, a pair of trousers inherited from his dead father, and a cheap jumper. The boy passed through the already deserted playground of the elementary school and climbed the hill beside the watermill. Mounting the flight of stone steps, he went on behind Yashiro Shrine. Peach blossoms were blooming in the shrine garden, dim and wrapped in twilight. From this point, it was not more than a 10-minute climb up to the lighthouse. The path to the lighthouse was dangerously steep and winding, so much so that a person unaccustomed to it would surely have lost his footing even in the daytime. But the boy could have closed his eyes and his feet would still have picked their way unerringly among the rocks and exposed pine roots. Even now, when he was deep in his own thoughts, he did not once stumble. A little while ago, while a few rays of daylight yet remained, the boat on which the boy worked had returned to its home port of Utajima. Today, as every day, the boy had gone out fishing on the Taihei Maru, a small engine-powered boat, together with its owner and one other boy. Returning to port, they transferred their catch to the cooperative's boat and then pulled their own up onto the beach. Then the boy started for home, carrying the halibut he was going to take shortly to the lighthouse. As he came along the beach, the twilight was still noisy with the shouts of fishermen pulling their boats up onto the sand. There was a girl he had never seen before. She leaned, resting against a stack of heavy wooden frames lying on the sand, the kind called abacuses because of their shape. The fishing boats were pulled up onto the beach, stern first, by means of a winch, and these frames were placed under the keels so they went sliding smoothly over one after another. Apparently, the girl had just finished helping with the work of carrying these frames and had paused here to get her breath. Her forehead was moist with sweat, and her cheeks glowed. A cold west wind was blowing briskly, but the girl seemed to enjoy it, turning her work-flushed face into the wind and letting her hair stream out behind her. She was wearing a sleeveless, cotton-padded jacket, woman's work pants gathered at the ankles, and a pair of soiled work gloves. The healthy color of her skin was no different from that of the other island girls, but there was something refreshing about the cast of her eyes, something serene about her eyebrows. The girl's eyes were turned intently toward the sky over the sea to the west. There, a crimson spot of sun was sinking between piles of blackening clouds. The boy could not remember ever having seen this girl before. There should not have been a single face on Utajima that he could not recognize. At first glance, he took her for an outsider, but still, the girl's dress was not that of outsiders. Only in the way she stood apart, gazing at the sea, did she differ from the vivacious island girls. The boy purposely passed directly in front of the girl. In the same way the children stare at a strange object, he stopped and looked her full in the face. The girl drew her eyebrows together slightly, but she continued staring fixedly out to sea, never turning her eyes toward the boy. Finishing his silent scrutiny, he had gone quickly on his way. At the time, he had felt only the vague satisfaction of curiosity gratified, and it was only now, much later, while climbing the path to the lighthouse, that he realized how rude his inspection had been. The thought filled his cheeks with shame. The boy looked down at the sea between the pine trees along the path. The incoming tide was roaring, and the sea was quite black now before the moon rose. Turning the bend around what was known as Woman's Slope, the ghost of a tall woman was said sometimes to appear here, he caught sight for the first time of the brightly lighted windows of the lighthouse still high above him. The brightness blinded him for a moment. The village generator had been out of order for a long time, and he was accustomed only to the dim light of oil lamps in the village. The boy often brought fish in this way to the lighthouse, feeling a debt of gratitude toward the lighthouse keeper. He had flunked his final examinations last year, and it had seemed his graduation would have to be postponed a year, but his mother, on her frequent trips past the lighthouse to gather firewood on the mountain beyond, had struck up an acquaintance with the mistress of the lighthouse, to whom she now appealed. She explained that she simply couldn't support her family any longer if her son's graduation were postponed. So the lighthouse keeper's wife spoke to her husband, and he went to see his good friend, the school principal. Thanks to this friendly intervention, the boy had finally been able to graduate on schedule. The boy had become a fisherman as soon as he finished school, and since then, he had made it a point to take part of the day's catch to the lighthouse from time to time. He also performed other small errands for them and had become a favorite of both the lighthouse keeper and his wife. The residence provided the lighthouse keeper was just to the side of a flight of concrete steps leading up to the lighthouse itself and had its own small vegetable garden. As the boy approached, he could see the wife's shadow moving about on the glass door of the kitchen. She was evidently preparing supper. He announced himself by calling from outside, and the wife opened the door.
"Oh, it's you, Shinji-san," she said.
The boy held the fish out without a word. The woman took it from him and called out loudly over her shoulder, this time using the boy's family name.
"Father, Kubo-san has brought us a fish."
From another room, the good-natured voice of the lighthouse keeper answered familiarly.
"Thank you, thank you. Come on in, Shinji boy."
The boy was still standing hesitantly at the kitchen door. The halibut had already been placed on a white enamelware platter, where it lay faintly gasping, blood oozing from its gills, streaking its smooth white skin.
Chapter 2.
Next morning, Shinji boarded his master's boat as usual, and they set out for the day's fishing. The overcast sky of daybreak was mirrored in a calm sea. It would take about an hour to reach the fishing grounds. Shinji was wearing a black rubber apron reaching from the breast of his jumper to the tops of his knee-length rubber boots, and a pair of long rubber gloves. Standing in the bow of the boat and gazing ahead to their destination in the Pacific, far ahead under the ashen morning sky, Shinji was remembering the night before, the time between his leaving the lighthouse and going to bed. Shinji's mother and brother had been awaiting his return in the small room lit by a dim lamp hanging over the cook stove. The brother was only 12. As for the mother, ever since the last year of the war, when her husband had been killed in a strafing attack, until Shinji had become old enough to go to work, she had supported the family all alone on her earnings as a diving woman.
"Was the lighthouse keeper pleased?"
"Yes. He said, 'Come in, come in,' and then asked me to have something they called cocoa."
"What was it, this cocoa?"
"Some sort of foreign bean soup, is what it seemed like." The mother knew nothing about cooking. She served their fish either in raw slices, sometimes vinegared, or else simply grilled or boiled, head, tail, bones, and all. And as she never washed the fish properly, they often found their teeth chewing on sand and grit as well as fish. Shinji waited hopefully during their meal for his mother to say something about the strange girl. But if his mother was not one for complaining, neither was she given to idle gossip. After supper, Shinji and his brother went to the public bath. Here again, he hoped to hear something about the girl. As the hour was late, the place was almost empty and the water was dirty. The head of the fishermen's cooperative and the postmaster were arguing politics as they soaked in the pool, their booming voices echoing pompously off the ceiling. The brothers nodded to them silently and then went to a far corner to dip hot water from the pool. No matter how Shinji waited and strained his ears, the men simply would not move on from their politics to talk of the girl. Meanwhile, his brother had finished bathing with unusual haste and had gone outside. Shinji followed him out and asked the reason for all his hurry. Hiroshi, the brother, explained that he and his friends had been playing at war today and that he had made the son of the head of the cooperative cry by hitting him over the head with his wooden sword. Shinji always went to sleep easily, but last night he had had the strange experience of lying long awake. Unable to remember a day of sickness in his life, the boy had lain wondering, afraid this might be what people meant by being sick. That strange unrest was still with him this morning. But the vast ocean stretched away from the prow where he was standing, and gradually the sight of it filled his body with the energy of familiar, day-to-day toil, and without realizing it, he felt at peace again. The boat was shaking mincingly with the vibrations of the engine, and the biting morning wind slapped at the boy's cheeks. High on the cliff to starboard, the beacon of the lighthouse was already extinguished. Along the shore, under the brownish pine branches of early spring, the pounding breakers of Irako Channel showed vivid white in the cloudy morning landscape. Two submerged reefs in the channel kept the water in a constant churning turmoil. An ocean liner would have had to work its way gingerly through the narrow passage between them, but with the skillful sculling of its master, the Taihei Maru sailed smoothly through the swirling current. The water in the channel was between 18 and 100 fathoms deep, but over the reefs it was only 13 to 20 fathoms. It was here, from this spot, where buoys marked the passage, on out to the Pacific, that the numberless octopus pots were sunk. 80% of Utajima's yearly catch was an octopus. The octopus season, which began in November, was now about to give way to the squid season, which would begin with the spring equinox. It was the end of the season, the time when the pots were lying in wait for their last chance at what were called the fleeing octopus, as they moved to the depths of the Pacific to escape the cold waters of the Gulf of Ise. To master fishermen, the exact rise and fall of every inch of the bottom of the shallow waters off the Pacific side of the island were as familiar as their own kitchen gardens. They were always saying, "It's only a blind man that can't see the ocean floor." They knew their direction from their mariner's compass, and by watching the changing outline of the mountains on the far distant capes, they could always tell their exact position. Once they had their bearings, they unerringly knew the topography of the ocean floor beneath them. Countless ropes had been methodically laid out over the floor of the ocean, to each of which were tied more than 100 pots, and the floats attached to the ropes rolled and tossed with the rise and fall of the tides. In their boat, it was the master who knew the art of octopus fishing. All Shinji and the other boy, Ryuji, had to do was lend their strong bodies willingly to the heavy labor involved. Jukichi Oyama, master fisherman, owner of the Taihei Maru, had a face like leather, well tanned by sea winds. The grimy wrinkles on his hands were mixed indistinguishably with old fishing scars, all burned by the sun down into their deepest creases. He was a man who seldom laughed, but was always in calm good spirits, and even the loud voice he used when giving commands on the boat was never raised in anger. While fishing, he seldom left his place on the sculling platform at the stern, only occasionally taking one hand off the oar to regulate the engine. Emerging into the fishing grounds, they found already gathered there the many other fishing boats, unseen until now, and exchanged morning greetings with them. Upon reaching their own fishing area, Jukichi reduced the speed of the engine and signaled Shinji to attach a belt from the engine to the roller shaft of the gunwale. This shaft turned a pulley which extended over the gunwale, One of the ropes to which the octopus pots were tied would be placed over the pulley, and the boat would slowly follow the rope along as the pulley drew one end up from the sea and let the other fall back into the sea. The two boys also would take turns at pulling on the rope, because the water-soaked hemp was often too heavy a load for the pulley alone, and also because the rope would slip off unless carefully guided. A hazy sun was hidden behind the clouds on the horizon. Two or three cormorants were swimming on the sea, their long necks thrust out over the surface of the water. Looking back toward Utajima, one could see its southern cliffs shining, dead white, stained by the droppings of countless flocks of cormorants. The wind was bitterly cold, but while he pulled the first rope toward the pulley, Shinji stared out over the dark indigo sea and felt boiling up within him energy for the toil that would soon have him sweating. The pulley began to turn, and heavy, wet rope came rising from the sea. Through his thin gloves, Shinji could feel the thick, icy rope he grasped in his hands. As it passed over the pulley, the taut rope threw off a sleet-like spray of salt water. Soon the octopus pots themselves were rising to the surface, showing a red clay color. Ryuji stood waiting at the pulley. If a pot was empty, he would quickly pour the water out of it, and not letting it strike the pulley, again commit it to the care of the rope, now sinking back into the sea. Shinji stood with his legs spread wide, one foot stretched to the prow, and continued his endless tug-of-war against whatever there was in the sea. One hand pull by one hand pull, the rope came up. Shinji was winning. But the sea was not surrendering. One after the other, mockingly, it kept sending the pots up, all empty. More than 20 pots had already been pulled up at intervals of from 7 to 10 yards along the rope. Shinji was pulling the rope. Ryuji was emptying water from the pots. Jukichi, keeping a hand on the sculling oar, and never once changing his expression, silently watched the boys at their work. Sweat gradually spread across Shinji's back and began to glisten on his forehead, exposed to the morning wind. His cheeks became flushed. Finally, the sun broke through the clouds, casting pale shadows at the feet of the quickly moving boys. Ryuji was facing away from the sea, in toward the boat. He upended the pot that had just come up, and Jukichi pulled a lever to disengage the pulley. Now, for the first time, Shinji looked back toward the pulley. Ryuji poked around inside the pot with a wooden pole. Like a person awakened from a long nap, an octopus oozed its entire body out of the pot and cowered on the deck. Quickly, the cover was jerked off a large bamboo creel standing by the engine room, and the first catch of the day went slithering down into it with a dull thud. The Taihei Maru spent most of the morning octopus fishing. Its meager catch consisted of 5 octopuses. The wind died and the sun shone gloriously. Passing through the Irako Channel, the Taihei Maru sailed back into the Gulf of Ise to do some drag fishing on the sly in the prohibited waters there. To make their drag, they tied a number of large hooks and lines on a crossbar, tied it to a stout hawser, and then, putting the boat in motion, dragged this across the floor of the gulf like a rake. After a time, they pulled the drag in. With it, 4 flatheads and 3 soles came flapping up from the water. Shinji took them off the hooks with his bare hands. The flatheads fell to the blood-smeared deck, their white bellies gleaming. The black, wet bodies of the soles, their little eyes sunk deep in folds of wrinkles, reflected the blue of the sky. Lunchtime came. Jukichi dressed the flatheads on the engine room hatch and cut them into slices. They divided the raw slices onto the lids of their aluminum lunchboxes and poured soy sauce over them from a small bottle. Then they took up the boxes, filled with a mixture of boiled rice and barley, and stuffed into one corner a few slices of pickled radish. The boat they entrusted to the gentle swell.
"Say, what do you think about old Uncle Teru Miyata bringing his girl back?" Jukichi said abruptly.
"I didn't know he had."
"Me neither."
Both boys shook their heads and Jukichi proceeded with his story.
"Uncle Teru had 4 girls and 1 boy. said he had more than enough of girls, so he married three of them off and let the other one be adopted away. Her name was Hatsue, and she was adopted into a family of diving women over at Oizaki in Shima. But then, what do you know? That only son of his, Matsu, dies of the lung sickness last year. Being a widower, Uncle Teru starts feeling lonely, so he calls Hatsue back, has her put back in his family register, and decides to adopt a husband into the family for her, to have someone to carry on the name. Hatsue has grown up to be a real beauty. There'll be a lot of youngsters wanting to marry her. How about you two, eh? Shinji and Ryuji looked at each other and laughed. Each could guess that the other was blushing, but they were too tanned by the sun for the red to show. Talk of this girl and the image of the girl he had seen on the beach yesterday immediately took fast hold of each other in Shinji's mind. At the same instant, he recalled, with a sinking heart, his own poor condition in life. The recollection made the girl whom he had stared at so closely only the day before seem very, very far away from him now. Because now he knew that her father was Terukichi Miyata, the wealthy owner of two coasting freighters chartered to Yamagawa Transport, the 185-ton Utajima Maru and the 95-ton Harukaze Maru, and a noted crosspatch whose white hair would wave like lion whiskers in anger. Shinji had always been very level-headed. He had realized that he was still only 18 and that it was too soon to be thinking about women. Unlike the environment of city youths, always exploding with thrills, Utajima had not a single pinball parlor, not a single bar, not a single waitress. And this boy's simple daydream was only to own his own engine-powered boat someday and go into the coastal shipping business with his younger brother. Surrounded though he was by the vast ocean, Shinji did not especially burn with impossible dreams of great adventure across the seas. His fisherman's conception of the sea was close to that of the farmer for his land. The sea was the place where he earned his living, a rippling field where, instead of waving heads of rice or wheat, the white and formless harvest of waves was forever swaying above the unrelieved blueness of a sensitive and yielding soil. Even so, when that day's fishing was almost done, the sight of a white freighter sailing against the evening clouds on the horizon filled the boy's heart with strange emotions. From far away, the world came pressing in upon him with a hugeness he had never before apprehended. The realization of this unknown world came to him like distant thunder, now pealing from afar, now dying away to nothingness. A small starfish had dried to the deck in the prow. The boy sat there in the prow, with a coarse white towel tied round his head. He turned his eyes away from the evening clouds and shook his head slightly. Chapter 3. That night, Shinji attended the regular meeting of the Young Men's Association. This was the name now applied to what in ancient times was called the sleeping house, then a dormitory system for the young unmarried men of the island. Even now, many young men preferred to sleep in the association's drab hut on the beach rather than in their own homes. There the youths hotly debated such matters as schooling and health, the ways of salvaging sunken ships and making rescues at sea, and the Lion and Lantern Festival dances, functions belonging to the young men of the village since ancient days. Thus they felt themselves part of the communal life and found pleasure in the agreeable weight that comes from shouldering the burdens and duties of full-grown men. A wind was blowing from the sea, rattling the closed night shutters and making the lamp sway back and forth, now dim, now suddenly bright. From outside, the night sea came pressing very near them, and the roar of the tide was constantly revealing the unrest and might of nature, as the shadows of the lamp moved over the cheerful faces of the young men. When Shinji entered the hut, one boy was kneeling on all fours under the lamp, having his hair cut by a friend with a pair of slightly rusty hair clippers. Shinji smiled and sat down on the floor against the wall, clasping his knees. He remained silent as usual,
listening to what the others were saying. The youths were bragging to each other of the day's fishing, laughing loudly and heaping each other unstintingly with insults. One boy, who is a great reader, was earnestly reading one of the out-of-date magazines with which the hut was supplied. Another was engrossed with no less enthusiasm in a comic book, holding the pages open with fingers whose knuckles were gnarled beyond his years. He would study some pages for 2 or 3 minutes at a time before finally understanding the point and breaking into a loud guffaw. Here, for the second time, Shinji heard talk of the new girl. He caught a snatch of a sentence spoken by a snaggle-toothed boy who opened a big mouth to laugh and then said, "That's Hatsue! She's..." The rest of the sentence was lost to Shinji in a sudden commotion from another part of the room, mixed with answering laughter from the group around the snaggle-toothed boy. Shinji was not at all given to brooding about things, but this one name, like a tantalizing puzzle, kept harassing his thoughts. At the mere sound of the name, his cheeks flushed and his heart pounded. It was a strange feeling to sit there motionless and feel within himself these physical changes that, until now, he had experienced only during heavy labor. He put the palm of his hand against his cheek to feel it. The hot flesh felt like that of some complete stranger. It was a blow to his pride to realize the existence of things within himself that he had never so much as suspected, and rising anger made his cheeks even more flaming hot. The young men were awaiting the arrival of their president, Yasuo Kawamoto. Although only 19, Yasuo was the son of a leading family in the village and possessed the power to make others follow him. Young as he was, he already knew the secret of giving himself importance, and he always came late to their meetings. Opening the door with a bang, Yasuo now entered the room. He was quite fat and had inherited a red complexion from his tippling father. His face was naive enough in appearance, but there was a crafty look about his thin eyebrows. He spoke glibly, without any trace of the local dialect.
"Sorry to be late." "Well then, let's not waste time. There's definite plans to be made for next month's projects."
So saying, he sat down at the desk and opened a notebook. They could all see that he was in a great hurry about something.
"As decided at the last meeting, there's the business of, holding a meeting of the Respect for Old Age Association, and also hauling stones for road repairs. Then there's the matter of cleaning the sewers to get rid of the rats. It's a request of the village assembly. We'll do this as usual, on a stormy day when the boats can't go out. Fortunately, rat catching can be done in any weather, and I don't believe the police will get after us, even if we kill a few rats outside the sewers."
There was general laughter and shouts of, "You tell him! You tell him!" Next, proposals were made to ask the school doctor to give them a talk on hygiene and to hold an oratorical contest. But the old-style lunar calendar New Year was just over, and the youths were so fed up with gatherings that they were lukewarm to both proposals. So they turned themselves into a committee of the whole and sat in critical judgment on the merits of their mimeographed bulletin, The Orphan Island. Something called a quatrain by Verlaine had been quoted at the end of an essay in the last issue by the boy who liked books so much, and this now became the universal target for their jibes.
"I know not why my mournful soul flies the sea fitfully, fitfully, on restless frantic pinions."
"What do they mean by fitfully, fitfully?"
"Fitfully, fitfully means fitfully, fitfully, that's what."
"Maybe it's a mistake for flitfully, flitfully."
"That's it. If you'd said it flies flitfully, flitfully, then that would have made some sense."
"Who's this Verlaine fellow, anyhow?"
"One of the most famous French poets, that's who."
"And what do you know about French poets, eh? You probably got it all out of some popular song somewhere."
Thus, the meeting had ended as usual in a give and take of insults. Wondering why Yasuo, the president, had been in such a hurry to leave, Shinji stopped one of his friends and asked him.
"Don't you know?" the friend replied. He's invited to the party Uncle Teru Miyata's giving to celebrate his daughter's homecoming.
Normally, Shinji would have walked home with the others as they talked and laughed, but now, hearing of the party to which in no case would he have been invited, he soon slipped away and walked alone along the beach toward the stone steps leading to Yashiro Shrine. Looking up at the village houses, built one above the other on a steep rise, he picked out the lights shining from the Miyata house. All the lights in the village came from the same oil lamps, but these looked somehow different, more sparkling. Even if he could not see the actual scene of the banquet, he could clearly imagine how the sensitive flame of the lamps there must be throwing flickering shadows from the girl's tranquil eyebrows and long lashes down onto her cheeks. Reaching the bottom of the stone steps, Shinji looked up the flight of stairs, dappled with shadows of pine branches. He began to climb, his wooden clogs making a dry, clicking sound. There was not a soul to be seen around the shrine, and the light in the priest's house was out. Even though he had just bounded up 200 steps, Shinji's thick chest was not laboring in the least when he reached the shrine. He stopped before it, filled with a feeling of reverence. He tossed a 10-yen coin into the offertory chest. Thinking a moment, he tossed in 10-yen more. The sound of his clapped hands, calling the god's attention, sounded through the shrine garden, and Shinji prayed in his heart. God, let the seas be calm, the fish plentiful, and our village more and more prosperous. I am still young, but in time let me become a fisherman among fishermen. Let me have my knowledge in the ways of the sea, in the ways of fish, in the ways of boats, in the ways of the weather, in everything. Let me be a man with surpassing skill in everything. Please protect my gentle mother and my brother, who is still a child. When my mother enters the sea in the diving season, please protect her body somehow from all the many dangers. Then there's a different sort of request I'd like to make. Someday, let even such a person as me be granted a good-natured, beautiful bride. Say someone like Terukichi Miyata's returned daughter. The wind came blowing, and the pine branches set up a clamor. It was a gust of wind that raised solemn echoes even in the dark interior of the shrine. Perhaps it was the sea god accepting the boy's prayer. Shinji looked up at the star-filled sky and breathed deeply. Then he thought, but mightn't the gods punish me for such a selfish prayer? Chapter 4. It was some 4 or 5 days later, and the wind was blowing a gale. The waves were breaking high across the breakwater of Utajima's harbor. The sea, far and wide, was choppy with whitecaps. The skies were clear, but because of the high wind, not a single fishing boat had gone out. Shinji's mother had asked a favor of him. The women of the village gathered firewood on the mountain and left it stored at the top in what had formerly been a military observation tower. His mother had marked hers with a red rag. Since he had finished by noon with the Young Men's Association work of carrying stones for the road building, she asked him to bring her gatherings down from the mountain for her. Shinji shouldered the wooden frame on which brushwood was carried and set out. The path led up past the lighthouse. As he rounded Woman's Slope, the wind died as completely as though it had been a trick. The residence of the lighthouse keeper was as quiet as though in a deep noonday sleep. He could see the back of a watchman seated at the desk in the watchhouse. A radio was blaring music. Climbing the pine grove slope behind the lighthouse, Shinji began to sweat. The mountain was utterly still. Not a single human form was to be seen. There was not even so much as a stray dog prowling about. In fact, because of a taboo of the island's guardian deity, there was not a single stray dog on the entire island, let alone a pet dog. And as the island was all uphill and land was scarce, neither were there any horses or cows for draft animals. The only domestic animals were the cats that came trailing the tips of their tails through the jagged shadows thrown in sharp relief in the lanes leading always downward in cobbled steps between the rows of village houses. The boy climbed to the top of the mountain. This was the highest point on Utajima. But it was so overgrown with sakaki and silverberry bushes and tall weeds that there was no view. There was nothing but the sound of the sea roaring up through the vegetation. The path leading down the other side to the south had been practically taken over by bushes and weeds, and one had to make quite a detour to reach the observation tower. Presently, beyond a sand-floored pine thicket, the three-story, reinforced concrete tower came into view. The white ruins looked uncanny in the deserted, silent scene. In former days, soldiers had stood on the second-floor balcony, binoculars to their eyes, and checked the aim of the guns that were fired for target practice from Mount Konaka on the far side of the Irako Cape. Officers had called out from inside the tower to know where the shells were hitting, and the soldiers had called back the rangers. This way of things had continued until mid-war, and the soldiers had always blamed the phantom badger for any provisions that were mysteriously short. The boy peeped into the ground floor of the tower. There was a mountain of dried pine needles and twigs tied into bundles. This floor had evidently been used as a storehouse, and its windows were quite small. There were even some with their glass panes still unbroken. The boy entered, and by the faint light of the windows, soon found his mother's mark, red rags tied to several bundles, the name Tomikubo written on them in childish characters. Taking the frame off his back, Shinji tied the bundles of dried needles and twigs to it. He had not visited the tower for a long time, and now felt reluctant to depart so soon. Leaving the load lying where it was, he was about to start up the concrete steps. Just then, there was a faint sound from overhead, as though of stone and wood striking together. The boy listened intently. The sound ceased. It must have been his imagination. He went on up the stairs, and there on the second floor of the ruins was the sea, framed desolately in wide windows which lacked both glass and casings. Even the iron railings of the balcony was gone. Traces of the soldiers' chalk scribblings could still be seen on the gray walls. Shinji continued climbing. He paused to look at the broken flagpole out a third-story window, and this time he was certain he heard the sound of someone sobbing. He gave a start and ran lightly on up to the roof on sneaker-clad feet. The one who was really startled was the girl on the roof, having a boy suddenly appear before her out of nowhere, without so much as a footfall. She was wearing wooden clogs and was weeping, but now she ceased her sobbing and stood petrified with fear. It was Hatsue. As for the boy, he had never dreamed of such a fortunate meeting and could not believe his eyes. So the two of them simply stood there, startled, like animals that come suddenly face to face in the forest, looking into each other's eyes, their emotions wavering between caution and curiosity. Finally, Shinji spoke. "You're Hatsue-san, aren't you?" Hatsue nodded involuntarily, and then looked surprised at his knowing her name. But something about the black, serious eyes of this boy, who was making such an effort to put up a bold front, seemed to remind her of a young face that had gazed at her fixedly on the beach the other day.
"It was you crying, wasn't it?"
"Yes, it was me."
"Why were you crying?"
Shinji sounded like a policeman.
Her reply came with unexpected promptness. The mistress of the lighthouse gave lessons in etiquette and homemaking for the girls of the village who were interested, and today Hatsue was going to attend for the first time. But coming too early, she had decided to climb the mountain behind the lighthouse and had lost her way. Just then, the shadow of a bird swept over their heads. It was a peregrine. Shinji took this for a lucky sign. Thereupon, his tangled tongue came unloose and, recovering his usual air of manliness, he told her that he passed the lighthouse on his way home and would go that far with her. Hatsue smiled, making not the slightest effort to wipe away the tears that had flowed down her cheeks. It was as though the sun had come shining through rain. She was wearing a red sweater, blue serge slacks, and red velvet socks, the split-toed kind worn with clogs. Hatsue leaned over the concrete parapet at the edge of the roof and looked down at the sea.
"What's this building?" she asked.
Shinji, too, went to the parapet, but at a little distance from the girl.
"It used to be a target observation tower," he answered. "They watched from here to see where the cannon shells landed."
Here on the south side of the island, screened by the mountain, there was no wind. The sunlit expanse of the Pacific stretched away beneath their eyes. The pine-clad cliff dropped abruptly to the sea, its jutting rocks stained white with cormorant droppings, and the water near the base of the cliff was black-brown from the seaweed growing on the ocean floor. Shinji pointed to a tall rock just offshore where the surging waves were striking, sending up clouds of spray.
"That's called Black Isle," he explained. "It's where policeman Suzuki was fishing when the waves washed him away and drowned him."
Shinji was thoroughly happy. But the time was drawing near when Hatsue was due at the lighthouse. Straightening up from the concrete parapet, she turned toward Shinji.
"I'll be going now," she said.
Shinji made no answer, and a surprised look came over his face. He had caught sight of a black streak that ran straight across the front of her red sweater. Hatsue followed his gaze and saw the dirty smudge just in the spot where she had been leaning her breast against the concrete parapet. Bending her head, she started slapping her breast with her open hands. Beneath her sweater, which all but seemed to be concealing some firm supports, two gently swelling mounds were set to trembling ever so slightly by the brisk brushing of her hands. Shinji stared in wonder. Struck by her hands, the breasts seemed more like two small, playful animals. The boy was deeply stirred by the resilient softness of their movement. The streak of dirt was finally brushed out. Shinji went first down the concrete steps, and Hatsue followed, her clogs making very clear, light sounds which echoed from the four walls of the ruins. But the sounds behind Shinji's back came to a stop as they were reaching the first floor. Shinji looked back. The girl was standing there, laughing.
"What is it?" he asked. "I'm dark too, but you're practically black."
"What?"
"You've really been burnt by the sun, you have."
The boy laughed in meaningless reply and went on down the stairs. They were just about to leave the tower when he stopped abruptly and ran back inside. He had almost forgotten his mother's bundles. On the way back toward the lighthouse, Shinji walked in front, carrying the mountain of pine needles on his back. As they walked along, the girl asked him his name, and now, for the first time, he introduced himself. But he went on hurriedly to ask that she not mention his name to anyone or say anything about having met him here. Shinji well knew how sharp the villagers' tongues could be. Hatsue promised not to tell. Thus, their well-founded fear of the village's love of gossip changed what was but an innocent meeting into a thing of secrecy between the two of them. Shinji walked on in silence, having no idea how they could meet again, and soon they reached the spot from which they could look down upon the lighthouse. He pointed out the shortcut leading down the rear of the lighthouse keeper's residence and told her goodbye. Then purposely, he took the roundabout way on down to the village.
Chapter 5. Until now, the boy had been leading a peaceful, contented existence, poor though he was, but from this time on, he became tormented with unrest and lost in thought, falling prey to the feeling that there was nothing about him that could possibly appeal to Hatsue. He was so healthy that he had never had any sickness other than the measles. He could swim the circumference of Utajima as many as 5 times without stopping. And he was sure he would have to yield to no one in any test of physical strength. But he could not believe that any of these qualities could possibly touch Hatsue's heart. Another opportunity to meet Hatsue simply would not come. Whenever he returned from fishing, he always looked all along the beach for her, but on the few occasions when he caught sight of her, she was busy working and there was no chance to speak. There was no such thing as that time when she had been alone, leaning against the abacuses and staring out to sea. Moreover,
whenever the boy resolved that he was sick of it all and that he would put Hatsue completely out of his mind, on that very day he was sure to catch sight of her among the bustling crowd that gathered on the beach when the boats came in. City youths learn the ways of love early from novels, movies, and the like, but on Utajima there were practically no models to follow. Thus, no matter how he wondered about it, Shinji had not the slightest idea what he should have done during those precious minutes between the observation tower and the lighthouse when he had been alone with her. He was left with nothing but a keen sense of regret, a feeling that there was something he had utterly failed to do. It was the monthly commemoration of the day of his father's death, and the whole family was going to visit the grave, as they did every month. Not to interfere with Shinji's work, they had chosen a time before the boat set out and before his brother's school. Shinji and his brother came out of the house with their mother, who was carrying incense sticks and grave flowers. They left the house standing open. There was no such thing as theft on the island. The graveyard was located some distance from the village, on a low cliff above the beach. At high tide, the sea came right up to the foot of the cliff. The uneven slope was covered with gravestones, some of them tilting on the soft sand foundation. Dawn had not yet broken. The sky was just beginning to become light in the direction of the lighthouse, but the village and its harbor, which faced northwest, still remained in night. Shinji walked in front, carrying a paper lantern. Hiroshi, his brother, was still rubbing the sleep out of his eyes when he pulled on his mother's sleeve and said, "Can I have 4 rice dumplings in my lunch today? Can I? Huh?
Such foolishness. 2 you'll get. 3'd more than give you the bellyache.
Please, I want 4.
The rice dumplings they made on the island to celebrate the Day of the Monkey, or on death memorial days, were almost as large as the small pillows they slept on. In the graveyard, a cold morning breeze was blowing fitfully. The surface of the sea in the lee of the island was black, but the offing was stained with dawn. The mountains enclosing the Gulf of Ise could be seen clearly. In the pale light of daybreak, the gravestones looked like so many white snails of boats anchored in a busy harbor. They were sails that would never again be filled with wind, sails that, too long unused and heavily drooping, had been turned into stone just as they were. The boat's anchors had been thrust so deeply into the dark earth that they could never again be raised. Reaching their father's grave, their mother arranged the flowers she had brought, and after striking many matches only to have them blown out by the wind, finally succeeded in lighting the incense. Then she had her sons bow before the grave, while she herself bowed behind them, weeping. In the village, there was a saying, "Never have aboard 1 woman or 1 priest." The boat on which Shinji's father died had broken this taboo. An old woman had died on the island toward the end of the war, and the cooperative's boat had set out to take her body to Toshijima for the autopsy. When the boat was about 3 miles out from Utajima, it was sighted by a plane from an aircraft carrier. The boat's regular engineer was not aboard, and his substitute was unaccustomed to the engine. It was the black smoke from his sluggish engine that had given the plane its target. The plane dropped a bomb on the boat and then strafed it with machine gun fire. The boat's funnel was split open, and Shinji's father had his head torn apart down to his ears. Another man, too, was killed instantly, hit in the eye. One was hit in the back by a bullet, which entered his lungs. One was hit in the legs, and one who had a buttock shot away died shortly after of the bleeding. Both the deck and the bilge became a lake of blood. The fuel tank was hit, and kerosene spread on top of the blood. Some hesitated to fling themselves prone in this mess and were hit in the hips. 4 persons saved themselves by taking shelter in the icebox in the forward cabin. In his panic, one man squeezed himself through the porthole behind the bridge, but when he tried to repeat the feat back in port, he found that no matter how he tried, he could not wriggle through that tiny opening a second time. Thus, Of 11 persons, 3 were killed and a number wounded. But the corpse of the old woman, stretched out on the deck under a rush mat, was not so much as touched by a single bullet.
The old man was really something fierce when fishing for sand lance, Shinji said reminiscently to his mother. He'd beat me every day. Really, there wasn't time for the welts to go down before he'd raise more.
Sand lance were found in the Yoshido shallows, and catching them required unusual skill. A flexible bamboo pole with feathers on the tip was used to imitate a seabird pursuing a fish under the water, and the operation called for split-second timing.
Well, I guess so, said his mother. Sand lance fishing is real man's work, even for a fisherman.
Hiroshi took no interest in the talk between his mother and brother, but was dreaming of the school excursion that was to take place in only 10 days more. Shinji had been too poor to go on school excursions when he was Hiroshi's age, so he had been saving money out of his own wages for Hiroshi's travel expenses. When they had finished paying their homage at the graveside, Shinji went on alone directly to the beach to help with the preparations for sailing. It was agreed that his mother would return home and bring him his lunch before the boats put out. As he hurried toward the Taihei Maru along the busy beach, someone's voice from out of the throng came to him on the wind and struck his ears.
They say Yasuo Kawamoto's to marry Hatsue.
At the sound of those words, Shinji's spirits became pitch black. Again, the Taihei Maru spent the day octopus fishing. During the 11 hours they were out in the boat, Shinji threw his whole soul into the fishing and scarcely once opened his mouth. But as he usually had very little to say, his silence was not particularly noticeable. Returning to harbor, they tied up as usual to the cooperative's boat and unloaded their octopuses. Then the other fish were sold through a middleman and transferred to the buyer ship, belonging to a private wholesale fish dealer. The gilt heads were flapping about inside the metal baskets used for weighing fish, flashing in the light of the setting sun. It was the day out of every 10 when the fishermen were paid, so Shinji and Ryuji went along with the master to the office of the cooperative. Their catch for the 10-day period had been over 330 pounds, and they cleared 27,997 yen after deducting the cooperative sales commission, the 10% savings deposit, and maintenance costs. Shinji received 4,000 yen from the master as his share. It had been a good take, considering that the height of the fishing season was already past. Licking his fingers, the boy carefully counted the bills in his big, rough hands. Then he returned them to the envelope with his name on it and put it deep in the bottom of the inner pocket of his jumper. With a bow toward the master, he left the office. The master had drawn up to the brazier with the head of the cooperative and was proudly exhibiting a cigarette holder he had carved himself out of a piece of coral. The boy had intended to go straight home, but somehow his feet took him of their own accord back to the darkening beach. The last boat was just being pulled up onto the sand. There were only a few men to turn the winch and to help it along by pulling on the rope, so the women, who usually only placed the abacus frames under the keel, were pushing from behind. It was obvious that no headway was being made. The beach was growing dark, and no trace was to be seen of the grammar school boys who usually came out to help. Shinji decided to lend a hand. Just at that moment, one of the women pushing the boat raised her head and looked in Shinji's direction. It was Hatsue. He had no wish to see the face of this girl who had put him in such a black mood all day. But his feet carried him on to the boat. Her face was glowing in the semi-darkness. He could see her forehead moist with sweat, her rosy cheeks, her dark flashing eyes fixed again steadily in the direction the boat was being pushed. Without a word, Shinji took hold of the rope. The men at the winch called out, "Much obliged!" Shinji's arms were powerful. In an instant, the boat was sliding up over the sand, and the women were running helter-skelter after it with their abacus frames. Once the boat was beached, Shinji turned and walked off toward home, not once looking back. He wanted terribly to turn around, but smothered the impulse. Opening the sliding door of his house under the dim lamp, Shinji saw the familiar expanse of straw mats turned reddish-brown with age and use. His brother was lying on his stomach reading, holding a textbook out under the light. His mother was busy at the cook stove. Without taking off his rubber boots, Shinji lay back, face up, the upper half of his body on the straw mats and his feet still in the